Chapter 12, The Middle Kingdom, Dynasty 11.
Welcome back. Let me do a little bit of recapping, just for a minute or two, about where we left off last time. If you'll remember, Egyptian civilization had totally collapsed. We were in what we called the First Intermediate Period. Perhaps it was caused by the last king of the Old Kingdom, Pepi II, who reigned for 94 years. Perhaps he just reigned too long, couldn't control the army, and maybe Egypt just sort of slid downhill. But whatever the cause, the political system collapsed. There was virtually total anarchy in Egypt. We have perhaps petty princes competing with each other, many people claiming that they were kings, but they weren't. And we have Lamentations, a body of literature where people are bemoaning the situation. Oh, things are terrible. We no longer have law and order. Remember, servants are wearing good clothes and ladies are wearing poor clothes. Things are topsy-turvy. Divine order has been upset. Well, don't be depressed. Egypt will be okay. Egypt always rises out of it. And after this first intermediate period, we have what we call the Middle Kingdom. Prosperity. Life is going to be good. But it's not going to be easy at first. And what we're going to talk about today is one of the two dynasties of the Middle Kingdom. There are only two dynasties in the Middle Kingdom, the 11th and the 12th. And we'll talk about the 11th, which is a kind of desire for unity. We will see kings fighting to sort of pull the country together, and then finally they'll get their act together. They'll succeed. One thing that makes it a little difficult to understand the history of this dynasty, for archaeologists as well as people who are just interested in Egypt, is that the kings all have the same name. The first kings of this dynasty are all named Intef. Now, they have a second name and a third name, but often we have fragments of documents, bits of stone, and we just have like Intef or maybe Int, and we know it's one of these kings, but we're not sure which one. But the theme to sort of keep in mind is this. The first kings, the Intefs, they're not really kings. They're trying. They are Theban princes, in a sense, who are trying to pull the country together. And then the next set of kings in this dynasty, the Mantuhoteps, they all have the same name too, they've done it. They've established. So in the beginning, we'll see struggle. And in the end, we'll see we've arrived. First, the Intefs. Their names, by the way, are important. If you remember, I said in ancient Egypt, names are very important. They have meaning. And this is how you can sometimes glean the political situation from a name. For example, our first Intef, Intef Seher Tawi. His name means something like causing the peace in the two lands. Tawi means the two lands, Upper and Lower Egypt. So by taking a name like this, we can see that he's focused on unity, Upper and Lower Egypt. He writes his name in a cartouche. Now, that's also a bit of optimism. He's saying, I'm king of Egypt. He's got his name encircled in this magical oval that means he's a king. He's not really. There's not much evidence that he's controlling Upper and Lower Egypt. But at least he's got aspirations. Give him credit. The next Intef, right, our second Intef, his name is Wa'ankh. It's Intef Wa'ankh. Ankh, if you remember, means life. Wa, established. So he's established in life. The most interesting thing I can tell you about him has nothing to do with his politics and how successful he was. We don't have much of the records from him. He's the first dog lover in history. Right? We have a record, a stela. Remember they carved those round top stones where they wanted to indicate something, leave it for posterity. And we have a stela. Right? It was found by an Egyptologist in 1860. And on this stela are five dogs, right? His dogs. And he just sort of wanted to commemorate that he had these five dogs. Has their names, you know, I think one was named Blackie, right? Kind of neat. And so he really liked his dogs. The Egyptians, by the way, were real pet lovers, real pet lovers. And it infiltrates into their art. Let me tell you what to look for when you go to the museum next or when you're looking through art books. When you see a picture, it's usually a tomb painting of a nobleman. When you see him seated on a chair, very common, you see the nobility seated on chairs, look underneath the chair. The artist rarely wasted that space. There is almost always going to be something under that chair. And usually, it's a pet. You will see a cat, sometimes even a baboon. And sometimes, though, it's not always a pet. Sometimes, if it's a lady, you'll see her cosmetics. You'll see a mirror. She's left her mirror under the chair so she can check out how she looks. But the Egyptians were real pet lovers. Cats were, of course, top number one pet. And then came dogs. And we have the dog, you know, called the whippet, which is really a descendant of the Egyptian pharaoh's hound. It's that kind of dog they had, this thin, wiry dog that looks a little bit like a small greyhound. That was an Egyptian dog. So we know this Intef was a dog lover, right? And he called himself King of Upper and Lower Egypt. I think it's a bit of a sign of progress that one writes his name in a cartouche, the next one calls himself King of Upper and Lower Egypt. And now the third Intef, right? The third Intef. His name is Nacht-Neb-Tep-Nefer, right? Something you can't exactly hum, but it's an important name. Nacht means mighty or victorious. Neb is usually lord, means lord. Tep is front or foremost or something like that. And Nefer means three things. You have your choice. Good, beautiful, or happy. Right? That's why you get a lot of women's names with Nefer in it, like Nefertiti or Nefertari, the beautiful one has come. So Nefer, you always think positively. It's either beautiful, good, happy. And so his name means something like the beautiful and strong champion or lord. Right? So he's really saying he's done it. Now, this is a man that we know really did do it. We know that he went north and fought. These are Theban princes. These are princes from the south. And he went north and actually fought the northerners. So he's really doing something about uniting the country. And he is, in a sense, the champion that Egypt had been looking for to unite. End of Intefs, right? They've struggled. They've tried to pull it together. They're on the right road. Then come the Mantu Hoteps. Now, Mantu Hotep. The god of war was Mantu. So the fact that these kings are taking war god names suggests they're going to battle their way. They're going to fight their way to unification. Or if they're not going to fight their way, at least they've seen other people fight their way and they know you've got to be tough. Hotep, of course, means to be pleased. That's why you get names like Amun-Hotep. Amun is pleased, right? So Mantu Hotep means the war god is pleased. And our first Mantu Hotep is Mantu Hotep Se'ankh Ibtawi. Se'ankh Ibtawi. Now Ib means heart. And Tawi we've heard before, the two lands. So it's something like causing the heart of the two lands to live. Right? Something like that. So, or maybe even he gives life to the heart of the two lands. But the idea is that he's the unifier. He's saying, the two lands live in me. And it's true. It's true. He really is a king of Upper and Lower Egypt in the full sense of the meaning of it. Now, what do we know about him? There we start to get a picture of a man. First, he's got resources. He's got money. Now, the reason we know this, you know, we don't have his bank account. We don't have listings of how much he had. But he builds a mortuary temple that is spectacular. Now, a mortuary temple was where the priests would go and pray for him after he was dead. You had to make offerings to the deceased. You didn't know when he was going to resurrect and go in the next world. So you needed a large facility where people could come and pay their respects, make offerings. And he built a mortuary temple that was spectacular. It's terribly ruined today. But he selected a spot called Deir el-Bahari. Now, you've probably heard it in connection with other things. Hatshepsut would build a wonderful temple there. But when he built there, it was pretty desolate. It's on the west side of Thebes, west side where the dead were buried. So it's a mortuary temple for the dead. And he chooses a spot right against the cliffs. It's a rather stark place. It's white, glistening white. There's nothing growing there. And you get these huge cliffs coming up. And right at the foot of the cliffs, he builds his mortuary temple. And it's a new kind of monument. It was revolutionary. It had, in the middle of it is a small pyramid on a kind of platform. And around the pyramid is what we call an ambulatory, a place where you could walk. It was colonnaded, and you could walk. Rather striking. And it took quite a bit of resources to build something like that. And this monument has been excavated many times. And you know, almost every time they excavate it, they find something new. The first excavator was a man named Edouard Navy, and he was excavating just at the turn of the century. And in the mortuary temple, right in the mortuary temple, beneath the paving stones, he found the burials of princesses, ladies of the harem of Mantu Hotep. Right? And then, a little bit later, about 20 years later, Herbert Winlock, an excavator for the Metropolitan Museum of Art, began excavating there again. Now, you may wonder, why excavate when somebody else has already excavated it? Well, the answer is, if you knew something that the other guy didn't know, the other excavator didn't know, you think you're going to find something. And that's what Winlock did. Winlock figured this way. He looked at the plans, and he saw there were shrines in the back, and he realized there should be a couple of more coffins, a couple of more burials for ladies of the harem. And he looked, and he found them. He found them. Interestingly, one of the ladies of the harem, her name was Mayet. Her name really means kitty, as in cat, a diminutive of cat. The ancient Egyptian word for cat was mea, as in meow, right? It was onomatopoetic, you know? The Egyptians loved words that were onomatopoetic. For example, cat was mea, one of the words for cat. Donkey was ea, right? And the one for wine, the ancient Egyptian word for wine, I think is onomatopoetic. It's erp. And I think it's like a burp, I think. The Egyptians loved that, you know? So Kitty was a lady of the harem. And Winlock found her coffin. She found her intact, virtually. And this lady of the harem was 5 years old. She was a little girl, right? So she was probably a daughter rather than a lady of the harem. She was really just, I guess we call her a palace kid. You know, she was one of the kids in the palace. You can learn a lot, by the way, from just a burial like this. The coffin of Mayat. It's an interesting coffin. It's rectangular. Real rectangular. On it is a simple band of hieroglyphs on the outside with two eyes painted on it. I think everyone who sees it says it's elegant. It's a simple rectangle made out of wood. That, by the way, is typical of Middle Kingdom coffins. So you can tell your coffins when you see them. If you see a simple box looking very much like a cedar chest, Middle Kingdom. It's later in the New Kingdom that you'll get the stylized anthropoid coffins shaped like a mummy. That's New Kingdom. We don't have them yet. So wooden box, Middle Kingdom, simple band of hieroglyphs, magical prayer usually, and on the side are usually two eyes. Now there are two eyes painted on the side of the coffin so the deceased can look out, so that she can, almost always, Middle Kingdom burials are on their side so they can look out the side of the coffin. Facing west, they know where they're going. So, Kitty's coffin tells us something, but also another development. And you'll see, it doesn't just happen. There's reasons for these things. In the Middle Kingdom, inside of coffins, inside, we start to get magical spells. The entire inside of coffins are covered with magical spells to help the deceased get to the next world. Now, why does this appear in the Middle Kingdom? Right? Why now? The answer is, one lecture back, the first intermediate period. This is what happened, almost certainly. If you remember, in the Old Kingdom, the pharaohs were building pyramids. And we had Unas, the last king of Dynasty 5, decide to put pyramid texts in his pyramid, magical spells in the burial chamber to help him resurrect in the next world. That's a new development. Dynasty 5, Old Kingdom. After him, the kings of the sixth dynasty thought it was a good idea, and they followed through and had what we call the pyramid texts in their pyramids. But now, what happens? Well, the pyramids, of course, are sealed. The pharaohs put inside. Pyramids are sealed. Commoner never has an idea of what's inside that pyramid. But then comes the first intermediate period. Lawlessness. No one's guarding the pyramids. This is when all the pyramids of Egypt were robbed. During the first intermediate period. That's when they break into the Great Pyramid at Giza. That's when they rob Sneferu's pyramid. That's when they go into the pyramids of the 5th and 6th dynasties and see pyramid texts. Now, commoners have now seen magical spells that help you resurrect. Wouldn't you want them? Wouldn't you want to resurrect? The pharaoh had this magical spell. Maybe if you have this magical spell, you can resurrect. So, you don't have a pyramid. Where are you going to put the magical spell? Inside your coffin. You've got a coffin. You'll put it inside your coffin. So in the Middle Kingdom, because people saw these spells in the first intermediate period and wanted them, they start writing the pyramid texts on the insides of their coffins, and we call them the coffin texts. Right? So it's a logical evolution. It doesn't just happen. But Kitty's rectangular coffin is an example of a typical Middle Kingdom coffin. Now, back to Mantuhotep, our great king of Dynasty 11. To some extent, the history of this dynasty is tied to one excavator, Herbert Winlock from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, excavated there in the 1920s and a little before. Winlock made a discovery that surprised even him one year. And it shows that Mantuhotep, I think, really did go to war and fight. The tombs of the nobility of this dynasty, not the kings, but the nobility, are around Mantuhotep's mortuary temple, cut into the rock. The idea was that the king, when he went to the next world, would be surrounded by his nobility too, so everybody could go. So there are many little rock cut tombs near this mortuary temple at Deir el-Bahari. In one of them, Winlock found piles of mummies. Piles of them. More than 60. And at first, Winlock thought they were a later burial, somebody reusing a tomb, maybe even in the Coptic period is what he thought, that is, in the first couple of centuries A.D. But when he looked at the mummies carefully, he noticed that on the bandages were names of the deceased, and they were Middle Kingdom names. They were names that are typical of the Middle Kingdom. I was curious. And then Winlock realized they were all males. Right? Kind of funny that they'd be all males in a communal tomb. Women were mummified and buried. He sent many of the bodies to Douglas Derry, who was an anatomist working at the university in Cairo, to examine them. And Derry said, not only are they all males, they're all in the prime of life. They're all young men. And then Derry saw very clearly that several of them had arrows in them. These were the soldiers of Mantuhotep, who had gone perhaps north to fight, and their bodies had been brought back for burial near their king's tomb. So Mantuhotep really did go out and do some battling. Interestingly, by the way, you can see one of these mummies, or part of it, just a part of it, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Metropolitan exhibits virtually everything they have, right? Everything. There's nothing in the basement. There are little side study rooms where the minor things are. And if you go to the Middle Kingdom section, in the study room, on a top shelf, on the right-hand corner, you will see a shoulder. Just a shoulder of a person. And if you look closely, it's not carefully labeled. It's not, say, hey, look at this. There's an arrow in that shoulder. That's one of Mantuhotep's soldiers. But Mantuhotep did do some battling. Now, Winlock continued to excavate in this area, and he made important discoveries. And one I want to use as an example of how excavators aren't always looking for objects. They're not looking for objects all the time. They're looking for knowledge all the time. There was a large tomb in the area, the tomb of Mekhet Re, who had been the chancellor of Mantuhotep. It had been excavated, thoroughly excavated, no chance of finding anything. But Winlock had a few extra days and a couple of workmen, and he decided he would clear the tomb completely so that he could measure it accurately, so that he could map it, just so we would have an architectural record of the tomb, wanting nothing more than the knowledge of it. They had just about cleared the tomb so they could do the measuring when a sharp-eyed workman, and usually, by the way, the local Egyptian workmen that we hire are very skilled. They know what they're doing. They know what they're looking for. And as he was sweeping out the sand, he saw that some of the sand was disappearing into a crack in the floor of the tomb. And he knew that probably meant there was something beneath. Maybe another tomb, maybe just a hole in the rock. But called Winlock, and they discovered an intact chamber, a little chamber, with funerary models. Now, let me explain what these are. In the Middle Kingdom, when you went to the next world, you wanted to have your servants with you. You wanted all the comforts of life. And you had made for you little models of the kinds of amenities, the servants you had in the previous world. So, for example, Mekhet Re, this wealthy man who would have had estates, I mean, he was the chancellor of the king. He had, they're almost like dollhouses, little dioramas, you know, maybe 3 feet square. little carved wooden figures. He had a butcher shop, and you can see the men slaughtering the cattle, meat hanging up to dry. There was a bakery and a brewery, always next to each other, by the way, in Egypt, the yeast. Wherever you find a bakery, you'll find the brewery next door, right? Always in Egypt. So when excavators find the large vats for the brewery, they look for the bakery. And he even had a model of his house. There were servant girls carrying produce back from the market. Beautiful things, really beautiful. But Winlock wasn't looking for treasure, he was just looking to map this thing. The models today are in two museums. In Winlock's day at excavating, and people often ask about this, do you get to keep the stuff you find? Today the answer is no. We really excavate just for knowledge, and the only thing you keep are your records. Everything stays in Egypt. Everything. But in Winlock's day, it was 50-50. It was a division of the finds. The excavator takes half back to his institution, if it's a university or a museum, and the Egyptian government keeps the other half. So half of these models are in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, where Winlock worked, and the other half are in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And you can see them. They're really quite lovely things. But that's one of the great finds of Winlock. But Winlock found many, many things of this period. And let me tell you one last kind of great find. Well, there's two more great finds he really did. One is the Tomb of Wa. After Mekhet Re's tomb, he found another intact tomb. An employee of Mekhet Re, a guy named Wa, which means established. He was established. He was pretty happy with himself. And Wa had an interesting bit of jewelry on his neck. He was buried with a silver scarab. A silver scarab, which was to help him exist in the next world. It's a carved beetle, or in this case, it's a molded beetle out of silver. But they had, when they buried Wa, they ritually killed the beetle. In other words, they took the silver amulet and they hacked out the eyes and the mouth so it couldn't by magic come to life and damage Wa. Right? A little bit of ritual killing. But anyway, let me tell you about one more Middle Kingdom discovery of Winlock. And you'll see sometimes the history of a dynasty is really one excavator's work. Winlock found a bunch of letters written by a man named Heckenacht. Now, Heckenacht had an interesting job. He was a Ka priest. Remember, the ancient Egyptians believed that the soul was made up of different parts. You were a Ba, B-A, which was your personality, and it was usually shown in the form of a bird with the head of the deceased. So it's a human-headed bird. And the Ba could kind of flit around while you were lying in your tomb waiting to be resurrected. But that was your personality. There was also the Ka, which was your double, kind of like your shape, your spiritual shape. And when you died, priests had to make offerings to your Ka, because the Ka needed sustenance too, had to eat. Now, if you were wealthy enough, you would hire somebody forever. Now, you know he's not going to last forever, but you have his family. You leave an endowment. And the deal is, you get this land, you come to my tomb once a day. On holidays, you might have to stay for 2 days, and make the offerings for my soul. Right? So you make a deal with a priest. And when you die, or if you're getting old, your son can take over. You still keep the land, and this forever makes sure that my Ka will get its bread and beer in the next world. Well, Heckenacht was that kind of priest. He was a Ka priest. And Ka priests very often would have to almost live in the tomb a couple of days, because you had to make the offerings. And he was a Ka priest for a man named Ippi. And sometimes he would have to sleep overnight, and he slept in a neighboring tomb, a smaller tomb. Now, Winlock, when he excavated that smaller tomb, found the equivalent of an ancient Egyptian wastebasket. Dug in a corner of the tomb was a little pit out of the dirt. When Heckenacht would come to the tomb and have to spend a lot of time there, he would write letters. And he'd take his correspondence with him, letters that he'd gotten, and he would write back to his family. And from these letters, he would draft rough drafts maybe, and then he would write it formally. And from the things that he threw away in the tomb and sort of buried in his wastebasket, he would just drop it in there, cover it with dirt. We learn a little bit about Heckenacht. He was a very querulous guy. He was always writing to his sons on his estate and sort of micromanaging everything, telling them, pay this amount of bushel of grain for this kind of cattle, and he would always end his letters with, and make sure my concubine isn't mistreated. Right? So he's always giving instructions to his sons. But Whitlock found these letters. They're called the Heckenach letters today, and because he excavated at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, they're there. You can go see them. But what's really neat about these letters is that Agatha Christie, whose husband was an archaeologist, a Near Eastern archaeologist, Sir Max Malawan, Agatha Christie, who knows Egyptology, she based a novel on these Heckenach letters. And it's not the one you might think, you know, Death on the Nile. That's set in modern time. It's called Death Comes as the End. And it's quite accurately based on the Heckenach letters. And I think you'll all enjoy it. So Whitlock helped us uncover the history of Mantuhotep. If you look at statues of Mantuhotep, though, there's an interesting thing to be learned from them. Mantuhotep had wealth. He was established. And his statues of himself show a kind of powerful man. They indicate power. But you know, they're not well made. They're kind of crude. And I think the reason they're crude is that during the first intermediate period, the royal sculptors, the royal studios where royal art was cranked out, were no longer supported. There was no king who had a royal studio. So in a sense, while he had the means, he had lost the skills, or at least the sculptors had lost the skills, to really produce fine art. So that's an interesting trait in the beginning of the Middle Kingdom. They'll get it back. They'll get it back, but not yet. They're not yet there. Now, what about Mantuhotep's successors, right? There's some Mantuhoteps following him. His successor, Mantuhotep Seach Ka-Re, causing the Ka of Re to live, right? Ka, the soul, Re is the god, right? Causing the soul of Re to live. He succeeded his father, a sign that things are going well. There's stability. The son succeeds the father. Now, he sent an expedition to the Wadi Hammamat. The Wadi Hammamat is an ancient caravan route. It had been used for thousands of years. It goes roughly between Thebes, just outside of Thebes it starts, and goes to the Red Sea, through desert. Treacherous. Not easy. Not easy by any means. But the reason Egyptians wanted to go to the Wadi Hammamat is that it was a source of fine black stone. The kind of stone that you see sometimes in sarcophagi, these black sarcophagi, almost always comes from the Wadi Hammamat. And he sent an expedition there of 3,000 men. That's a sign that you're established. 3,000 men going there wasn't easy. And the overseer of these men even records, we dug 12 wells along the way so the men would be okay. They even have little details. You know, the men who kept the record of these expeditions, this was something you'd remember for the rest of your life. So these guys have things like, and I supplied 2 pots of water for every man on a pole that they carried on their shoulders. Or they had donkey loads of sandals, because the sandals were wearing out from marching. Right? So it's quite a good thing to be able to send an expedition to the Wadi Hammamat. This is a dynasty that's established. Now, his successor, another Mantuhotep, Nebtawi Re, which means something like Re is lord of the two lands. They're unified. He also sends a Wadi Hammamat expedition. This one of 10,000. Big. Imagine all the sculptors, the chisel men, the men who are going to take care of the tools. And there's one little detail about this expedition that's quite something. They were looking for a stone that's just right for the sarcophagus of the pharaoh. And when they arrived, a pregnant gazelle came in front of them. And they followed this pregnant gazelle, and she gave birth on a stone that was just right for the pharaoh. Unfortunately, the record also says they sacrificed the gazelle, right? Because they thought this was a great sign. But this is a dynasty that can build large temples. They can send expeditions to the Wadi Hammamat. They can bury their princesses in nice coffins with jewelry. This is Egypt reestablished. Now, it's only one of 2 dynasties in the Middle Kingdom. Next time, we'll talk about the next dynasty. See you then.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachingcompany.com. teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.